sometimes when I'm in certain frames of mind, particularly on very hot days around the North Circular, I can feel time radiating off of pre-moulded concrete lintels.
Welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with John Rogers and Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that looks at the rich tradition of early 20th century topographical walking guides to London and the South East and what use they might be to us today.
They're kind of like inlet valves for some unmediated cosmic energy.
Each week, we'll be taking a trip through the pages of a different book as if we are on a wayward topographical ramble.
Because I know they're actually just technology, they're applied machinery, but they seem to me almost to be kind of like storage vats of regional memory.
Hello and welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Nick Papadimitriou, and my co-host John Rogers. This is a show that explores the world of early 20th century walking guides to London and the South East.
And this week, we'll be taking a ramble through the pages of Pathfinder's A Foot Round London.
A Foot Round London, being a wayfarer's guide to the field and meadow paths, woodland and forest tracks round London, with such random philosophy and open-air happenings as there is room for. By Pathfinder. Exploration, I hope no one has said this before, begins at home. Now that the North Pole has been reached and Cook's tourists penetrate to Patagonia, there is very little undiscovered country left outside England for the roving, adventurous individual to explore. But in England, and especially within an hour's ride from London, there are vast tracts of terra incognita still left. It would require a long investigation to determine why, during the last 40 or so years, these formerly travelled districts have ceased to attract the foot of the wayfarer and explorer. If cycles made people desert the footpaths and follow the roads, the coming of the motor should have reacted on them and made them take once more to the footpaths. But as far as my experience goes, and I speak as a lover of the unexplored heart of England, it has not done so. All over the south of England, vast tracts of beautiful country, crossed and seamed by countless footpaths, waste their sweetness on the desert air as if they were under some strange ban. It used not to be so. Time was when we were a nation of walkers and used to take to the road and footpath on every possible occasion.
That was a reading by Hayley LePayne from the introduction to A Foot Round London by Pathfinder with music by Fabrizio Patalini. Last week we talked about Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London from 1925. That we described, I suppose slightly jokingly, but not really, as being like our holiest of all holy books, as if we were somehow in this series assembling the Gospels that might form some kind of topographical rambler's Bible. I hope you allow me to take that flight of fancy. This book, Pathfinder's A Foot Round London, was the number two on the list. Something that particularly my co-host Nick Papadimitriou here was very keen to have at the top of the show. And in fact, Nick, you did a talk at the Leytonstone Festival a couple of years ago called A Foot Round London, didn't you, about the whole thing of topographical walking guides. It shares similarities with Maxwell's work, most obviously in the ridiculously long subtitle. But I think going on to a more sort of, I suppose, serious note, what you can see there with Pathfinder is even writing in 1911, which is, he looks like he wrote this book over the summer of 1911, that he is seeing walking in the suburbs as like an antidote to global tourism. That the greatest adventure one could have would not be in Patagonia or in Borneo or Malaysia, but would in fact be in the sort of suburban hinterland around London, finding wonder and adventure in everyday familiar landscapes. This made me think of what I read something that Grail Marcus said about what he saw in psychogeography when he was writing about the situationist practice of the derive in psychogeography. I think Lipstick Traces was written in 1988, I think. So he's writing this a full 77 years after Pathfinder wrote the words that Haydy just read. And he described the psychogeographical derive as being about discovering the unknown facets of the known, innocence in the face of experience, astonishment on the terrain of boredom. Which I think there is a... I think Pathfinder would have signed up to that, don't you think, Nick?
Oh, absolutely.
And he laments the decline of walking in 1911, at an age when the motor car was still in its infancy. And I love the way that he sort of almost naively believes that somehow motor transport might make people take to the paths once more and walk again once more. And I wonder if he'd have known that, you know, the rate we're going is something that your friend Will Self pointed out, actually, at the current decline of walking by 2050. Nobody will walk anymore.
I will. One thing you have to remember, though, is that there were plenty of cars on the road by then. I mean, by 1910, I think the Middlesex County Council were already planning the North Circular Road. And it was only prevented from happening by World War One. That's why most of us tend to think of the big arterial roads as being an interwar project. But they were being planned not far after the turn of the 19th, 20th century. And although it's hard to get a full insight into what the impact of that on the landscape was at that time, one thing that's quite easy to do is to underestimate how prevalent cars were already becoming.
That's interesting, isn't it? And also, I think, as well, at that point in time, there wasn't really the idea of road walking that we have. I mean, certainly, I think I grew up country walking because I grew up near the Chilterns, but certainly sort of in my 20s and 30s when I became more interested in this as a conscious practice, it's essentially road walking. But when you look at the old topographical walking guides, they don't really get into road walking at all. In fact, S.P.B. Mays, in one of the books that we'll be talking about later on in the series, it isn't far from London, says that road walking is dead. And I think he wrote that in 1931. Because I think the Victorians had been into road walking, hadn't they? Sort of Victorian pedestrianism.
They certainly had. And C.E.M. Joad, in his book, What was that book called?
The Untutored Townsman's Guide to the Country, isn't it?
Invasion of the Countryside. He takes a poop at road walkers. He sees it very much as a student left-wing thing. And although he was left-wing himself, he was a bit of a snob and he liked his country walks.
I think a lot of these blokes were snobs, actually. Not that I mind that. I'm not down on them for it. But there is sometimes a slightly pompous air. Don't you think? Last week, Professor Christine Blumel, to give her her full and proper title, described Maxwell's prose style as this sort of pseudo-18th century prose style.
I think distance walkers tend to become a bit snobbish and antagonistic towards the mass by nature. I mean, poor old Ian Sinclair is frequently accused of being a bit of a snob. And I know that when I walk, I come back down off the hills at dusk and catch a 2:10 bus on the Barnet Bypass and look at everyone and think, you don't know where I've just been. I've just been back to 1936. Where are you coming from? The office? And it's awful and I feel so bad about myself for doing it, but I'm not going to stop doing it.
Well, but luckily we weren't too afflicted with that when we finished the walk that we did for this programme on Sunday, because that ended in Loughton. Which is actually quite confusing. I mean, I'm not going to go for lazy sort of cliches there, because Loughton's posh, isn't it? I mean, that's a wealthy area, Loughton. But obviously it has some of the more, let's say, easily available cliches about the sort of Essex that people tend to make. In fact, that part of Essex that we're going to describe later on in the show with the walk, sort of between Chigwell, Loughton, and I can't remember where the other place is. I think it's Thaden Boys. Is described as the Essex Golden Triangle by some journalists. And apparently there was a TV show called Essex Wives that was set out in Chigwell. The question that I think it begs is that when we talk about these books and these authors, I think the first thing, you sort of buy into the books, and you get really into the books, and you think, oh, these are wonderful, I must do these walks. This person is a prophet of our walking religion. Second question you ask, a bit like other religions, is who was the author of that book? And with Pathfinder, we don't seem to be able to know who he was.
Well, I certainly haven't been able to discover who Pathfinder was, although, as you know, I have a tentative theory. It's a little bit slim on the ground. One thing we know about him was that several of the essays in A Foot Round London had been previously published in the Evening News, and we know that he was publishing walks in the Evening News during the war years, because what I have here in my hand, bought from the 2J's bookshop in Edgware for £2, is a little maroon slim volume called Round About London, which is basically a scrapbook that contains cuttings from the Evening News of Pathfinder's walks. And towards the back of the book, the walks begin to be called Walks During Wartime. And this is World War One we're talking about here.
That is an incredible object you're holding there, Nick. It really is. This is where you wish there was some vision with radio. Then I suppose it would be TV and it would be rubbish. But it's a little red book, as Nick's described it. And he held it out and it's got an embossed cover. So you think that's a published book. But actually, somebody must have got that book embossed. Especially because they've done that. They've glued those columns in, haven't they, as they've...
I suspect the newspaper made it available. You could order it to put your Pathfinder clippings in, so you could take them in your rucksack with you when you went walking. And, in fact, I have done a couple of these walks with this in my rucksack. What's surprising about Pathfinder is how coherent the walks still are. When we walked the other day, and we'll be coming on to that in a second, we went for a walk on Sunday from Grange Hill. In theory, we were going to go to Waltham Abbey. We didn't quite make it.
Not quite. We didn't get
anywhere near
it. We
ended up in a wimpy bar in Loughton, in fact. But
I'm going back to that wimpy bar. It was great.
But what was surprising about the walk was that apart from a few tracks becoming B roads and A roads, the walk, for the main part, was still coherent. And for the main part, the footpaths he described were still accessible, although there was one unfortunate difficulty.
Well, we won't say too much about that. We have a field recording of what actually transpired, what went down when we came run adrift there. I think we should probably, let's play a recording, a reading from the book. This is some of the advice that Pathfinder gives. This is one of the things I love about these walking books, is they give you some advice about what to take and how to walk and how to have the experience. Here you go. This is Hayley LePain reading Field Fair's advice on what kit to take walking.
In the matter of kit for a long tramp, it is impossible to be dogmatic, but here are my preferences. Old and easy thick-soled boots, brown for choice. Unlined woolen clothes, also old and easy, with large patch pockets that button outside and will take a folding quarter-plate camera. A soft felt hat of the kind the Germans call a Rieshut. I bought mine 6 years ago in Basel for one and threepence. It is a limp, easy folding, broad-brimmed article, weighing under 2 ounces, or an unlined cap. A walking stick of ground ash with a right-angled top that fits the palm comfortably, a light satchel or rucksack for weekend walks, maps, a compass, if you don't know the trick of using your watch as one, a book of any sort that interests you in case of bad weather or long waits for trains, tobacco of your favourite brand if you smoke, all these are more or less necessaries for the walker.
Well, I didn't take any tobacco because I don't smoke, but I thought that was wonderful. It's interesting to look at what we took to see how much the walker's kit may have changed. What did I take? I took a copy of E.N. Buxton's Epping Forest, Addison's Epping Forest. There's a lot of books actually have the title, just Epping Forest. Something to record this radio show on. So that was actually it's mini discs. So I suppose that's 20th century technology. Stupidly took a video camera, which slowed us down. Didn't take any food or drink. Pathfinder would have really been not... I didn't take anything. What a fool. I did take half a packet of lockets, though, which came in very useful to sort of lubricate my mouth. And I took a 1970s OS map of North East London, sheet 161. What did you have with you, Nick?
Well, I had the OS 174/125,000th map, and if I recall correctly, that was the map we used.
Yeah, that's the map
for the main part. That was the map that got us lost at one point. And I also took a large packet of Nicorette because I gave up smoking, I'm ashamed to say, 2 years ago, and I'm still on the Nicorette. That's a generic, of course. It was actually Boots Nicassist. And I was wearing a pair of trousers that I bought from a charity shop that have got their button missing, and a pair of German walking boots, and my 1960s gay honky-tonk hat, which I always wear on my walks these days.
Russian gay. You definitely look Russian and gay at the same time. Actually, that was the last outing for a pair of boots I've had for 2 years. Sorry for people listening. You're probably thinking, I didn't really need to know that. I wanted to know about Pathfinder. I just wanted to get out there to give those boots a proper morning. I suppose, you know, that walk that we did, how many walks are there in the book, Nick? There's probably, what, about 20, 25 walks?
Well, I should say A Foot Around London by Pathfinder is divided into two volumes, North and South, and obviously we use the North book. We won't be using the South of the Thames book in this series, but we might do in our next.
So also, to resolve a little argument me and Nick have been having, I'll give you our email address. It's deeplibrary@yahoo.com. Now, Nick's got these books, and they are beautiful, and the picture on the front is wonderful. We'll try and put a scan on the website, which is venturesintopography.wordpress.com. But what they have in the corner, the bottom corner, is a blue sticker that says Walks Around London South, Walks Around London North, of the kind that you would find on a book in a high street bookstore today. Now, Nick's adamant that these books date from 1911. I'm pretty sure they weren't sticking stickers on the covers of books in 1911. Maybe if someone out there knows about this, when stickers started being used on the covers of books, come on, someone's bound to know that, hive mind and all that business, please let us know.
I think you could be a bit more reasonable about that, John. I mean, are you an expert on the book trade? I worked in the book trade for several years. And another thing that I have to say about these books is that they're inscribed on the inner sleeve of both volumes in pencil, Gordon S. Maxwell. I believe that these books belonged to Gordon S. Maxwell and that he used them as a basis for some of the walks that he wrote down about in his Fringe of London.
Now, I've always been a bit sniffy about that whenever you've mentioned it, but I'm going to go with you, actually, because there is that thing. They do share a stylistic similarity, don't they? Apart from the fact that I think Pathfinder just gives descriptions of walks, whereas, you know, Gordon S. Maxwell does things like, you know, has conversations with ghosts and the whatnot.
So does Pathfinder. In the meadows of Middlesex, his walk from Edgware to Bushy, he meets a young French man, an onion Johnny, I think they used to call them, cycling around selling his onions in Middlesex. Poor chap's just about to go into the army, and we can't help think about World War One looming. But he has a conversation with this Frenchman and takes the mickey out of the Frenchman's attempt at pronouncing English words. That seems to me to be very Maxwellian, both Donald and Gordon S.
And I have a real affection for Pathfinder for what he wrote about the village where I grew up, which is not far from Beaconsfield and High Wycombe, and he actually says, this is very apposite of him, Woburn is a spot that a rambler would do well to linger in. There you go. We did a walk on Sunday and recorded it for this show. Which walk was it, Nick? Can you say a bit about what walk it was, mate?
Yeah, we went walking through Epping Forest, and we started off at Grange Hill Station on the Central Line, and our ambition was to get to Chigwell and then through to Loughton and then thread up through Epping Forest past High Beach towards Waltham Abbey. It was quite an astonishing walk, actually. I met John and our friend Peter Knapp, who takes photographs of us at Grange Hill Station, and we walked up your actual Grange Hill towards Chigwell Row. We all had to stop for 20 minutes. We were astonished at the view that we could see across the Thames Valley towards the Kentish Hills and towards, apparently, Buckholt Beaches, which is near Seven Oaks, although I do rather think that is an exaggeration, but that's what several topographical commentators have claimed you can see from Grange Hill.
I'll play that little clip, actually, now. We did record Nick's response to that at the time as he's looking out across towards the places he just described that I didn't absorb.
What have you seen, Nick?
Well, we're up in the Essex Heights and we're looking right down across the Thames Basin towards Shooter's Hill. To the right I can see the city with Margaret Thatcher's penis clearly displayed.
Yeah.
And we're looking down across the flats of Fairlop and Newbury Park.
Is that Shooter's Hill in the distance there, is
That's
it?
That's right, yeah. And beyond that, look, you can see right over to the Kent Hills and the North Downs. He's probably looking over towards Ainsford.
Where's Ainsford?
In Kent.
We turn off the road in a minute and strike off across country, okay?
Well, there we were, capturing that view, drinking it in. I've been wanting to go to Chigwell for a while, actually, because I have a famous namesake, John Rogers the Martyr, who was the rector of Chigwell, and he was dragged from Chigwell in 1555 and taken to be burnt at stake at Smithfield because he was one of the early Bible translators. So I sort of had a resonance. I'm sure if I wanted to really make something out of that when we write this for the blog, I'd probably waffle on about heretics and stuff. And there's what else did we notice about Chigwell, Nick? Wasn't there something about springs, medicinal springs in Chigwell?
Well, remember, before we got to Chigwell proper, where the school and the King's Head pub is, we got to a little hamlet called Chigwell Row. That was at the top of Grange Hill. And there was a pub there called the Maypole. We were slightly confused about something that Pathfinder said. Pathfinder describes a pub called the King's Head in Chigwell and says that it forms the basis for Charles Dickens' The Maypole pub in Barnaby. Is it Barnaby Grudge?
Oh, Lord. Barnaby Grudge. I think with a bad joke, it's three strikes and you're out, isn't it? Because he did that twice on Sunday and I let him get away with it and he's done it again.
John's got a grudge.
Oh, God.
Anyway, we got to Chigwell Row and we saw this pub, the Maypole, and we were all a bit confused. It looked to me, actually, like it was a stagecoach roadhouse from the 18th or possibly early 19th century, he said, bearing his architectural knowledge on his sleeve. And we were all wondering about whether we should go in and describe and check whether what Pathfinder described as being inside the Maypole was inside this pub, and it was completely the wrong pub. It's an interesting place, Chigwell Row, though. It's still a very small place, and it has a bit of a little history. Joseph Billabeer, who introduced the omnibus to London in 1826, I think
it was. Is
that
Shillabeer?
Shillabeer. What did I say?
You said Billabeer, but that's all right.
I'll speak to you afterwards, John.
Oh, it's interesting as well, because it was a resort. I mean, you go there now, it's fairly sleepy. I imagine that looking at the cars that are on the driveways, you know, it's fairly affluent, probably sort of city workers, Premier League footballer or two, maybe. But there was a medicinal spring there that was, I love this, where they thought the waters were puffed by a Dr. Freewin. Puffed, obviously, must mean sort of bringing them to the surface and making them drinkable. And it became quite a popular place to go out and drink the waters. So it would have been moderately well known in sort of Georgian London. And Stuart London. We're going to play a reading from the introduction to the chapter on our Epping Forest, and then we'll go straight into a field recording of me and Nick, expert topographers that we are, following Pathfinder's directions across the Essex fields.
Chapter 4, Our Forest of Epping. Most people approach Epping Forest wrongly. They take train to Chingford or Loughton and then complain that the place is spoilt by excursionists or suburban villas. It is a mistake. This walk is a roundabout route that crosses the most picturesque and deserted part of the forest's 6,000 acres, gives three fine views over different river valleys, makes a halt at a fine old Dickensian, pardon the adjective, wayside inn, and ends at the ancient Abbey of Waltham.
There's no clearly definable footpath. Now, this would be where a compass would have been useful. and I should have brought a compass, but it looks like we bear just to the sort of like through that way.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Straight across the field.
Compass would be really useful here.
Cross the Rodding and follow the right hand footpath to Loughton Station. Are you sure this is where we're supposed to?
Yeah, I've already plotted it all out in fine detail from the original map.
His next stop is Loughton Station.
Yeah, look. Here we are now. We've just turned off that road. There you go, look. Through to Loughton.
He doesn't give
across the roading.
But there's a good 3 mile stretch. He gives no indication at all of how you're supposed to get there.
He's more detailed than Pathfinder, than G.S. Maxwell is. We do go north of the farm, which is sort of along there.
Yeah, I don't think we've got any choice, have we? Yeah. I don't think we can do another lap of this field. Looking for a footpath that clearly doesn't exist anymore. There doesn't seem to be any way around.
So there's me and Nick wandering around in a path. That was pretty soon after we started, Nick, and we wandered around that field trying to find the out on that path for... we did 3 laps of that field, didn't we?
We did indeed, and I'm ashamed to say I got slightly heated, but John was compassionate enough to scratch those recordings. And after that, we took a diversion down a little closed tarmac adams country lane called Pudding Lane, which was rather marvellous, with a stream running alongside. I wondered if it wasn't the Chalybeate Spring that was... mentioned in some of the old history books about Chigwell Row. Beautiful strings of bryony berries growing above the ditches. I should have brought that compass.
Yeah, why didn't you bring your compass? Because you said it in the audio recording, I think I can, it was about 5 times, and Pathfinder expressly says 2 things, study your maps and bring your compass. I did actually contact Essex County Council about that footpath on Monday, and they were really, really helpful about that, actually. They obviously take their footpaths very seriously. And apparently, at the moment, there are literally hundreds, if not up to 1,000 applications pending for either the alteration or the opening of new footpaths. So they're actually looking into that, because I think, you know, to be fair, it was blocked off and was closed off. I think I'd like to play another field recording now, for about a minute, actually, so we'll have to we're running out of time, so we'll have to fade it out before the end. But here's another little bit of field recording from that walk on Sunday.
Love the old red rusting tractor there.
I think the public transport's still a bit rudimentary out here in Essex.
What does it say on their thing?
Ernest Doe and Sons Limited of Poulting or something.
Poulting?
Maldon, Essex.
Yeah. Phone Matfield Peverell 311, 10 lines.
This is what we dreamed of, isn't it?
Yeah. I think when you walk down footpaths like this, this is where you start to believe in the idea that some of these footpaths are the remnants of Iron Age tracks.
And that's further enforced by the state of that tractor, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be that old, couldn't it?
I love it. Buxton, in his Epping Forest book, he imagines the forest, parts of the forest, being as untouched as they were in time.
Unfortunately, we had to fade out before Nick got his beautiful Loughton gets his name from Louts, which I did go for there. It's been a wonderful show today. We've got to go. We're running out of time rapidly. I suppose we have to do our little bit of end of show admin, sort of thanks and stuff. We haven't received any emails yet. This is the third show, so please send us an email to deeplibrary@yahoo.com. Ooh, it's just spam, actually, at this point. I'd take some spam. The website is venturesintopography.wordpress.com. The podcast of last week's show on Gordon S. Maxwell is now available to download. Thank you to Hayden LePayne for the readings, Peter Knapp for his photographs, James, Stephen Finn here for driving the desk. The show will be repeated on Monday at 10 p.m. And next week we are doing James T. Bones, the London Perambulator. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, James. Thanks, Resonance. Bye-bye.